Committee on House File 92 will come to order. So, Representative Winkler, you received our...
We received your offer.
Right.
And I think we had asked that Dolly come back and kind of give us a overview of their sense of kind of how that would work enforcement-wise.
Okay.
And so...
That would be what we do now, then. Thank you. Commissioner Luman?
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Well, we took a couple hours and put together some information, so please forgive any incompleteness or anything that I try to correct this morning, and I hope to make it as clear as possible. Again, for the record, my name is Jessica Luman. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, oversee the Wage and Hour Division there. By a little way of background, just wanted to put some context on this. We talked a little bit about this the first day, but there are currently 1.5 million hourly workers in the state of Minnesota. DLI has four investigators for minimum wage, overtime, child labor, and wage claims in the state. Of the 1,500 cases that we investigated, that we closed last year, so we have many open at a time, but we closed over 1,500 cases last year. About half of those investigations and 20% of the wage claims are minimum wage claim cases. So that kind of shows you the volume of the work that we do in this area. We put together a handout for you. Hopefully you have it in front of you. And I kind of just like to walk through this, and I'm happy to answer any questions as we go. Thank you. Again, there might be a typo or two. The first page just explains, sort of diagrams out what the current minimum wage structure is in the state of Minnesota. You'll see that the wage thresholds are included in this illustration. And we currently have four minimum wages. We have the $6.15 large employer rate. We have the $7.25 federal rate, which applies to employers that are over $500,000 in revenue. We have the $5.25 rate, which is for employers who are under $500,000 in annual revenue. And we have the training rate, which can apply to all employers in the state of Minnesota for their workers who are in their beginning of their job for the first 90 days of employment for workers who are under 20. So that's 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds, all under 20 can be paid that $490 for the first 90 days of employment. Okay? So we were asked by the committee to take a look at the Senate proposal that was offered yesterday afternoon. And so we tried to take that proposal and similarly illustrate it based on our understanding. And so what we understand that this would do is we think it will create sort of six minimum wages for us to administer at the Department of Labor and Industry. The first minimum wage would, for starting from the top, would be the $8 an hour. And this is the first tier. So this is starting in August of 2014. The first rate would be that $8 an hour, which would be revenues over $625,000 a year for the employer. The second is, because there's still that gap between what the federal minimum wage requirement is and what our minimum wage requirement is, there would still be some employers who would be able to pay $7.25 an hour if their annual revenues were above $500 and below $600,000 a year, if covered by federal law and not otherwise excluded. Then we maintain that $5.25 for the small employers. And again, this is, I hope we got this right. And that's for workers, for employers who are under $500,000 automatically fitted that $5.25 as long as the workers are not in interstate commerce and not otherwise covered by law. We'll talk a little bit about that later. Then we have this youth wage, which actually it should be all large employers. Just to clarify that. And that would be $7.25 for all employees that are ages 17 and under. So under 18, so 17, 16, 15-year-olds, where that's applicable. And that would be until they turn 18. And then the training wage remains the same, which is for the first 90 days employment for all employees 19 and under. And then we also have this sleep hours provision, which is another minimum wage that would apply, and it would be currently $7.25 under the proposal. So that's sort of the six rates. We did, just for discussion purposes, include what the chart would be if we used the current House proposal, just by way of side-by-side comparison. And that would create a three-tiered system that would create the three tiers, which is it would make that cutoff at 500,000. So above 500,000, which is the same as the Fed, we would eliminate that gap of where the federal applies and the state doesn't apply. And then we would have under 500,000, and then it would maintain a training wage in that proposal. Again, just to quickly go through this the way we understand it. The proposed Minnesota large employer rate that we're discussing today that we've been asked to look at has this graduated increase over 3 years, starting at 8, then 9, then 9.50. And that would apply to all workers working for businesses that have over $625,000 in revenues. Under the Senate proposal, again, we would still have that gap between 500 and 625. So we've tried to explain when that gap might apply, which is employers grossing more than 500 in annual sales, grossing less than 625,000 in annual sales, and individual workers who are in interstate commerce. This was one of those the big questions that we had, so we actually wrote down the interstate commerce piece for you. So the next slide kind of explains that interstate commerce piece a little bit better, and it lists some workers that are in interstate commerce and therefore would not be eligible for the small employer rate in Minnesota because they qualify for the federal minimum wage. Sense? Then going on, the current Minnesota employer rate, small employer rate, which stays the same under the current proposal, applies to workers that are not in interstate commerce and working for a business that has under $500,000 in annual revenues. Workers covered by the Minnesota law only, just wanted to talk a little bit about, we were talking about those who are excluded from federal coverage. These workers under this proposal would be paid based on the size of the employer. So if it's over 625 or under 625 under the Minnesota standard, because the federal law doesn't apply. And the examples of those workers that would be covered under Minnesota law because they're not covered under federal law are some agricultural workers, some seasonal workers, newspaper workers, some fishing operations, and then the personal care service workers. This is an interesting area, and we'll talk a little bit more about it in the sleep time provision as well. The current Minnesota training wage, I kind of explained this already. It's available to all employers in the state of Minnesota, and it applies to workers who are under the age of 20 and during the first 90 days of employment. We estimate that there are about 111,000 hourly workers under the age of 20, and that approximately 29,000 of those currently make $7.25 or less. The youth wage proposal. So we talked a little bit about the tiered gaps and that piece. The youth wage proposal we also looked at separately. This is a new minimum wage that would be applied to the state of Minnesota. It would apply to all large employers, and that would be the Minnesota definition of large employers, which would be $625,000 or more, but it's already the minimum wage for $500 and more. It applies to workers under the age of 18. Currently, there are approximately 50,000 youth workers, which means people who are under 18 who are working. Approximately 20,000 of these make $7.25 or less now. We were asked specifically to look at what it would take for the Department of Labor and Industry to administer these new pieces. We would like to stress that the more tiers that we have in the basic, large, small, and federal, the more difficult it is to enforce generally. But the two specific provisions we looked at for enforcement purposes was the youth wage and the sleep time provision. The youth wage piece is a little bit tricky. We do actually have a child labor initiative currently going on at the Department of Labor and Industry where we are working with employers and young people to identify appropriate work for kids and making sure that they understand their rights and making sure they understand what is expected of them in the workplace. So we do have some resources already put toward this type of work. That being said, some of the administrative questions that we had about this kind of proposal are how a worker may move back and forth because of the combination of the youth wage and the training wage. Because a group of those workers, it applies to both. They could be at 490 and then go to 725 and then be at 490. Or they could move around in that range, but they would still be subject to that lower rate. A little bit of the ironic part is that they could be at 725 when they were 18 and then move back down to 490 when they, 725 when they're 17 and then move back down to 490 when they're 18, which is just a little bit difficult for us to make sure that the workers, once they've passed that 18, are still making the appropriate wage rate under that training piece because we don't have additional resources to look at that training wage for the 19 and 20-year-olds. Something we could look at, but that's not what we currently how we currently allocate our resources. One of the biggest challenges we have at the Department of Labor and Industry, and again, most employers want to do the right thing, and they want to pay the right rate, and they do. One of the biggest challenges we have is record keeping. The way that we can determine whether or not a worker was paid appropriately is the employer's records. And that's an ongoing challenge and education activity that we do to ensure that employers keep accurate records in terms of what they're paying workers, what hours are worked, what type of work is being performed. With any additional wage rates, there become additional record-keeping requirements. And that's one of the things that we outline here is that there would be additional record-keeping requirements for when an employee's birthday happens, whether they change their wage rate, all of those kinds of things. Just something else for us to look at. And then an ongoing issue that we have is the way that overtime is calculated is it's based on the regular rate of pay. When there can be blended rates, when there can be more than one rate of pay, it makes it more difficult to calculate what the appropriate overtime is, which makes it more likely that somebody won't do it right. The more difficult it is, the easier it is to make mistakes. So that's sort of our review of the youth wage proposal. We also took a look at the sleep time proposal, which is a little bit trickier in some ways because under the authorizing language, there's no definition of a long-term care provider in 245A. Who's licensed under 245A isn't defined. There's no long-term care provider under that licensing statute. So that would be tricky to determine who it actually applies to. And then also what sleep hours are. There's no definition of what sleep hours are. We have some sleep time requirements under our current rules, but those would need to be amended in order to more accurately define what sleep hours are for long-term care providers. And then, again, right now there's an exemption for companionship services that you don't have to pay for a certain number of sleep hours if the work shift allows them to sleep and they're in a certain definition. That is actually becoming obsolete. The companionship sleep hour provisions are becoming obsolete as of January 1, 2015, because companionship services will then be covered by federal law and no longer only covered by Minnesota law, and all hours will have to be paid at the federal minimum wage. So that part is, frankly, tricky for us, is this sleep provision. As the way it's written, the federal minimum wage, sleep hours could actually exceed the state minimum wage because it's tied to the 29 CFR. So in the event the federal minimum wage rate was to go up and the employer wasn't otherwise covered by the federal minimum wage, the worker could have to be paid more to sleep than not to sleep, which is kind of a tricky piece. Employees could forego sleep in favor of a higher wage, which could create safety issues, which is also a concern of the Department of Labor and Industry, the workplace safety issues. Again, we have record-keeping challenges, especially work time, wake time, who decides, how do we keep track, how does that demonstrate it on a time card, how is that verified. When we get a complaint from a worker who says we weren't paid the appropriate minimum wage, we have to look at the records, and we don't know how good they're going to be able to be. And finally, we have the blended rate of the for calculation of overtime. And just a general comment, and this goes back to the 500,000 threshold, it's very difficult for the state to enforce federal minimum wages. We can only enforce those wages that apply to us. So we would have, for example, under the current proposal, we could only enforce and do currently only enforce 525 for employers that may be required to pay $7.25 an hour. We will often refer those to the U.S. Department of Labor, but that seems to in some ways be doing a disjustice to the worker who's come forward and actually, you know, tried to seek help from the government. We can say, well, we can get you $2 an hour less than you could get if you go over there and ask the federal government to help you. So that's a general comment, is that it's very difficult for – we can't. In very limited circumstances, can we enforce the federal minimum wage for any Minnesota state workers? We can only enforce the minimum wage that's established by the Minnesota legislature. The final thing I brought to you is just a little illustration, which is these posters. It's mandatory in Minnesota that every employer post have a minimum wage poster posted where all employees can review the information so that they can understand their rights. If you see the one that says current law, it's a little complicated, but we got a lot of information right there on one piece of paper. And these, again, are available on our website. They're mandatory posters. You can download them for free for us. There are private entities that also take this information and publish them on really big posters that can be purchased by employers. This is the current poster that we have. You'll see that there's the small employer, the large employer with asterisks, and the federal covered employees with double asterisks. And then there's references below that as to who that applies to. There's the training wage, and then there's an explanation of two different overtimes, and then there's an employee rights piece. We did a mock-up of what the poster would look like under the Senate proposal. We have small, large, small employers, double asterisks, training wage, youth wage, and sleep hour wage. So we've basically created an entirely different poster that would have to basically explain what the employee's rights and what they were supposed to be getting under the Senate proposal. This is by way of illustration. This is complicated stuff. And again, the people that we're working with and trying to help in this area really need to be able to understand the information as clearly as possible. The employers need to know so that they can pay the right wage, and the employees need to know so they know what their rights are. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Luhmann. Are there any questions from the committee? Not Great. Seeing any. Thank you.
Thank Good. You.
It was very thorough. Thank you.
Thank you.
And on short notice.
Yes, in 2 hours. So, Representative Winkler, do you have any offers to make? Or?
Madam Chair, I do.
Okay.
I have only a few copies, but hopefully enough for Senate members and staff. I can just go over it as you pass them out. This is an effort to move in the Senate direction on some key points. The Department of Labor and Industry presentation on enforcement of various multiple state minimum wages, I think, illustrates the value of simplicity. And so in our offer, what we essentially do is reduce the small employer minimum wage rate that was in our current bill by 25 cents and reduce the training wage rate that was in our bill by 25 cents. We drop a quarter per hour in both of those as fully phased in, but maintain the structure, the simple structure of three minimum wages, large, small, and training. We maintain the $500,000 definition so that we don't have a state definition that is different from a federal definition that may create more confusion in the law. So it maintains the simplicity. It moves down the rate a little bit for small employers and for the training wage in order to I don't know exactly what the goals are of the Senate in terms of those issues, but it at least moves in the direction by reducing the rate. And the other thing that we offer is to change, and I know this is, I don't know who's kind of defining inflation, but we make an offer to change away from a consumer price index definition of inflation and move to an implicit price deflator definition of indexing. And the reason we, there's some more stability and consistency over time in the implicit price deflator. And frankly, I've heard that Senate leadership has some interest in that measure as opposed to CPI. Before yesterday, I'd heard that. So it's an effort to kind of see if there's a bridge out there on indexing and to try to make some moves towards the Senate on those other categories and to see where we can go from there in discussion.
Thank you for your proposal here. Should we recess?
I gave you my only copy.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Got one. Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Wicklund, thank you for the proposal. I think it's, absolutely done in good faith. I think if I may propose, Madam Chair, that we take a good look at this and kind of get a better understanding of what we think this may or may not do. And then at that point, Madam Chair, I think we should recess and spend some time on this and then hopefully get back together later in the day.
Okay. Any other comments? Trying to see if I have any questions.
It's the same format as what we provided yesterday.
Seven and eight.
That's, Madam Chair, the section 7 and 8 are the leave provisions, which we also suggested yesterday as bills that are moving separately and don't need to be part of this discussion.
And do you have an explanation of the implicit price deflator?
The implicit price deflator, based on national data for personal consumption, is a statistic put together by the Bureau of Economic Analysis at the Department of Commerce. It is a well-known, well-reputed measure of changing prices, and it is based on consumers, but it is a different calculation than the CPIU, and it is more of a chained type CPI, so it assumes that consumers change their behavior as prices go up. And if you remember the controversy of the Obama administration proposing to change the cost of living adjustment for Social Security by chaining it to assume that seniors are going to start making different choices if prices go up, and sort of what a concession that was, and kind of the howling of folks on that offer in his budget. Well, this is not exactly the same, but it's a similar type of change.
I don't know that much about it. Do you have any kind of data that shows like the last 10 years of what this looked like?
Madam Chair, we can get that for you.
That would be awesome. Thank you.
Metzen had a question. Metzen.
Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out that this is what we use in the taconite tax code and found to be the most stable over the last many, many years that Senator Tomasoni, my predecessor, and many others have used. So we thought that this would be a good way to bring it back to something we understood and was more reasonable than maybe the consumer price index in the Senate's mind.
Thank you. I'm sure that clarifies it for Senator Tomasoni.
We thought about just indexing it to the price of tax.
they wouldn't get a raise.
Okay. Is there anything else, or should we go into recess? We'll recess to the call of the chair.
Thank you.
Solved all the world problems.
Didn't we, though?
Yeah.
Let's see. It's March 5th, 2014. The conference committee on House File 92 will come to order. So, members, we have an offer, and Senator Hayden, will you run through it for us, please?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the conference committee. I don't know if you have it in front of you. We have an offer. The first provision is that The Senate will accept the House offer to drop House Sections 7 and 8 because we know that that is in other bills and that should be moving along. The Senate will offer Senate lines 1.16 to 1.22. I think we're all pretty familiar with that. That is the original offer that I made, I guess, now 2 days ago of going to 950 in over 3 years. And then we would continue to work with the House in negotiating the Senate language on small business and the training wage. And once again, Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, members of the committee, we just wanted to continue to show a good faith effort in talking about these issues. We did take a look at your offer and talk to our leadership team as well as members of our caucus that had a sense that had really talked a lot about this issue of indexing, and we weren't able to get agreement on that. And so at this point, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, members of the committee, we are unable to move forward on the new version of the escalator or indexing or the other versions of it. So, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, that's our offer. Of to date, we once again want to continue to stress that we know that we need to get this done, and we're hoping that we can continue to move forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hayden, so this says it's a global offer and it's offering these provisions. Was it your intention to not pursue the youth wage or the sleep wage rate, or is that what's your intention regarding
you
those
know,
two provisions?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler. I think that it's just kind of language there. I think we still need to have that conversation, but we wanted to, you know, we're still kind of focused on kind of the two big issues that we have there. So, you know, we anticipated that this probably isn't where the House is yet, so maybe we might not have put global offer, but at least an offer that we can start.
Okay.
I don't know where global came from.
Probably cut and paste would be my guess, Matt. Copy paste. Well, I you know, it doesn't look like we're making a lot of progress. I think from the House's standpoint, it's hard to move forward very quickly without a bigger, you know, more exploration and discussion around indexing. I know that that's something that is a hard thing for the Senate, and it's a hard thing for the House not to do. And so it may be that we're just better off having some discussions offline and seeing what other creative solutions we can pass back and forth, if there are any. And, you know, that we're kind of where we've been, you know. So I don't know. It sounds like we're kind of that we're at a stalemate for now, and maybe some other discussions can help move us.
Well, Representative Winkler, do you think that we could agree that 7 and 8 are that we both agree that 7 and 8 could be taken off the...
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, I guess I think if we're offering kind of the same language back and forth, we're effectively agreeing to that, so...
Okay. I just wanted to be sure.
And, you know, I hesitate to thank the Senate for its generosity in accepting our offer to take a section out of our bill, but...
Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
He actually wanted to leave it in.
Well, I will say that...
Senator Hayden, if you force us, we'll put that back in.
Well, I do want to say that, you know, I think both of us really think that these provisions are very important as they run through. I don't want anybody to get the message that we don't. We're just trying to see if we can start to do a little bit of a side-by-side and cleanup. I will say that our caucus is going to meet again today, our regular scheduled meeting. I don't know when you guys meet.
Tonight.
So I'm sure this will be a big topic of discussion. So, you know, I do hope that we will report back, not if people haven't been watching, kind of what has happened and what those offers look like. And so I'm hopeful that we can continue to get new and fresh ideas that might help this along.
And I meant to say earlier, this has to be a shorter meeting. We could recess and come back. But, in fact, our caucus is meeting in here at 5. So
So we'll have to adjourn.
So, Madam Chair, maybe they can leave some subliminal notes on the...
Yeah, well, Senator Hayden, it's not that subliminal. We actually brought some handouts that explained some of the issues related to the inflator that in various models. And so if to the extent that senators want more information or to better understand that, we've got copies here of that, too.
I appreciate that, Representative Winkler. But I don't know how many more ways to say it, but... The inflator is a non-starter in the Senate. I don't have the votes. I'm honest to God. but we would be more than happy to vote on the 950 over 3 years.
And, Madam Chair, I know you are. So I think at this point we're not prepared to do that, and I think we need to just continue to have discussions and see if there's a possibility of some evolution in the House's thinking on the inflator and some evolution in the Senate's thinking on the inflator, because in the end, I think it's in all the interest of all of us and certainly working Minnesotans to get a deal done sooner rather than later. And I think it would be better this session if we could get this issue taken care of, because I'm afraid of this kind of spilling over down the road and it can get unpleasant. And I don't think that's in anybody's interest. So I think we can continue the discussion and recognize that both sides may have to find some ways to evolve on their bills, but maybe sitting here at a conference table isn't the best way to do that.
I appreciate that, Representative Winkler. I will tell you that I'm starting to get nervous with the emails that we're all getting from different constituents objecting to the 950 that, you know, nobody's told me that they were going to not support it anymore yet. But I'm getting nervous because I'm getting some pretty intense ones. And so I guess that's part of the reason why I keep pushing to get that agreed on and to get it set in our report, our conference report. So
I think Representative Metz said that.
Representative Metz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out my colleagues on the second floor over in the House. I thought that they had printed these up for the inflation discussion we were having, and just wanted to show you the button that they had in support of our inflation. And secondly, I did want to point out that many of the emails I've also noticed are coming from the same folks over and over again. And so I was kind of confused reading some of them who were encouraging me just a few days ago to take the Senate position. And then now from those same email accounts are encouraging me not to. So I would say, maybe they need to decide what they want as businesses to and allow us to have more of a discussion.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Metz, I mean, I think it's not about us reacting to emails coming in. It's about trying to make sure we're doing the right thing and understanding what the issues are. And, you know, Senator Hayden, I would offer that if you have any senators who have questions about it or don't see the value in an inflator, I'd be more than happy to talk to them, and I'd be more than happy to hear concerns that folks have about why they think it's a bad thing for their constituents or a bad thing for their district and try to see if there's some way to accommodate any reasonable concerns they have.
Good. Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Representative Winkler. We think that's a great offer, and if they ask to speak to you, I'll make sure that they go directly to them. And I say that in this, that I think that the Senate has been very engaged in this process, and I've served in both bodies, and we both got crack research staff that really help us kind of walk through it and answer those questions. But I would offer the same, which is to say that I think that there's a practical kind of movement that is going, especially related to all the work that we got to do, that people think that, getting to 950 and that offer really is going to help people immediately, and that there is somewhat of a nuance around the inflator. And though we understand, those of us have been looking at it, how important it is, or it most certainly the House has really kind of articulated how important it is and for future legislatures to, like, not have to weigh in to this issue. So we fully understand it, but I do think there's a real practical aspect to not only getting this done, but getting it done so that we can show a sign to the workers that we really care about it. So I think that's just the sentiment of the senators that I've been speaking to, but I can assure you that they have looked at this through and through. There's a lot of people in this room on both sides of the issue that have helped us. Our staff has. So, and we'll talk about it. We'll continue to talk about it, and that's the commitment we make to you guys.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. We have some scheduling issues tomorrow. We have, I believe, Senator Tomasoni is not available after 3:30. And so do you have any idea when you'd like to meet, or are we going to meet tomorrow?
Yes, Senator, Madam Chair, I'm not sure that we need to call a meeting tomorrow. I think that calling a meeting for the sake of a meeting, absent some more substantive progress, might just be counterproductive. So if it wouldn't hurt anybody's feelings, at this point I'm not planning to call something. Friday then would be the Senate turn. Saturday would be the House. I can promise you I'm not going to call it for Saturday.
Oh, no.
Unless, of course, Senator Hayden or Senator Eaton comes forward with an indexing offer that the House just can't say no to. We may want to strike when the iron's hot there. But
so barring
absence,
any...
Barring that...
we're looking at Monday.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's reasonable.
Well, and Madam Chair, I want to thank Senator Winkler for offering to talk to the senators, because we actually offered to do that, and then no one's come to our offices yet, so maybe we can get them to your office and then talk to you in the meantime. And, but I honestly got to think what the chair just said about people getting cold feet on the 950 as a result of some feedback here is pretty important, and we should think about that, because for us to go up to this number is a really big step compared to where we were at the end of last session. And I am actually very surprised that the chair was actually able to coerce enough people into voting for 950 that we could actually pass it on the Senate floor. And we may be missing an opportunity here to get this up to 950. So you may want to think about that seriously.
Is there anything else?
Oh. I would offer to carpool Senator Tomasoni if that offer did come out on Saturday. So.
Oh, I didn't offer anything. Other than 950 without inflation.
So the conference committee will adjourn till Monday at the chair, call of the chair.
Yes. All right. I bet they never thought this would be a